It is Monday, June the 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, migration tensions in Europe.
The anti-Brussels line, the anti-EU line, and the anti-refugee line are all tied in together in the same mix.
Ceasefires in Afghanistan and what all that means.
I think that the government of Afghanistan is trying to figure some way out of this stalemate.
U.S.-China trade, Stephen Hawking laid to rest, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Rescued migrants turned away by Italy and Malta arrived at the Spanish port of Valencia on Sunday, ending a Mediterranean odyssey which some analysts say became symbolic of Europe's failure to agree on immigration. Spain offered to help the 629, mainly sub-Saharan Africans. Jose Sanchez is Spain's Red Cross, program chief.
There are 123 unaccompanied minors, and their destination will be the Centers for the Protection of Minors. All unaccompanied minors that arrive in our country are put under the care of the System of the Protection of Minors, and they will be taken to centers where they will be given all the care that any unaccompanied minor receives.
Italy's rejection of the rescue ship from Doctors Without Borders prompted a spat with France, while the issue of immigration has triggered a political row in Germany. VOA's Victor Beatty asks our MIT University Europe scholar Benoit Campmark if the prospects are at all good to resolve the issues over migration.
Well, they only get it resolved if there's a kind of a unified will and understanding at Brussels in the EU level about how best to deal with arrivals into the EU zone. The reason why this particular situation manifested itself is because the new government in Italy, and certainly very much characterized by the policy of Matteo Salvini, who is a very, he comes across as a hardline advocate for border controls. He was the one who said that Italy had been for too long accepting refugees as the first point from particularly Africa. And he said that the time had stopped to turn Italy into a refugee camp, and he didn't want Italy becoming a refugee camp for Europe. So his argument has been that other countries need to also shoulder the burden, which they have been reluctant to do so far.
The leaders of France and Germany meet in Germany on Tuesday. This obviously is going to dominate their talks.
Yes, it will be, because both countries are facing problems on that front too, particularly Germany, because Angela Merkel's government is divided in terms of how to respond to this. The German Interior Minister is particularly at odds with his Chancellor on the subject of dealing with refugee intakes and the regulation behind it and borders and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that, whether there's a unified front between the two major European powers, because this is a problem that's only intensifying.
You have top officials in Europe, Interior Minister of Germany, as you indicated, joining his counterparts from Italy and also Austria in forming what's called an Axis of the Willing to oppose illegal immigration.
Yes, this so-called Axis of the Willing, as you point out, can also be built or has built upon, for example, resistance to the new arrivals by, for example, individuals such as Viktor Orban of Hungary, who's led the grouping known as the Visegrad countries in terms of how they cope or not cope, as it were, in some cases, with the refugee arrivals. So they have formed a split group from the general EU consensus as to how to deal with this, and have developed an approach that deals with, for example, the necessary creation of detention centers, the control at exit entry points, and, of course, a firmer border control. So all of this is actually very much a counter to the standard notion of acceptance that's generally characterized EU policy when it comes to arrivals.
As you know, Benoit, this migration issue has brought to the fore a number of populist governments, those who are expressing concern about this matter. Is this another one of these issues, like Greece, that could potentially, or the Eurozone, that could divide Europe?
Oh, definitely. In fact, I would say that the anti-Brussels line, the anti-EU line, and the anti-refugee line are all tied in together in the same mix. In a sense, Europe's problems now are such that if they don't solve the refugee issue, they won't solve also the EU dysfunction, which is happening, because a lot of the populism, the populist movements that have arisen, the Liga movement and the Five Star movement in Italy, for example, which has produced the orientation at the moment, and of course the protests and the groups taking place in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary, all of them are products, as it were, of suspicion of Brussels on the one hand, but also suspicion, broadly speaking, about just having faceless bureaucrats, as it were, tell elected governments what to do, and that's the tension. And until the European mechanism can be sorted out that deals with the distribution that's equal and on par, that's certainly going to exacerbate this problem.
Dr. Benoit Capmark is a senior lecturer at Australia's RMIT University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. Pope Francis has urged people to value the contributions of migrants, and he's called for the adoption of a global pact on refugees. Those remarks made after his weekly Angelus prayer on Sunday.
Mercoledì prossimo ricorrerà la giornata mondiale del rifugiato, promossa dalle Nazioni Unite.
Next Wednesday will be World Refugee Day, promoted by the United Nations to draw attention to what our brothers, who are forced to flee their land because of conflicts and persecution, live through, and often with great anxiety and suffering. This year, this day falls in the wake of consultations between governments for the adoption of a global pact on refugees that is due to be adopted within the year, a pact for safe, orderly, and regular migration. I hope that the priorities involved in these processes will reach an agreement to ensure, with responsibility and humanity, the assistance and the protection of all of those who are forced to leave their country. More than 1.8 million migrants and refugees have arrived in Europe since 2014. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Also making news, the Taliban has rejected an extension to a 3-day ceasefire coinciding with the Eid al-Fitr holiday. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has announced a 9-day extension of the ceasefire after a suicide bombing killed 36 people on Saturday in hopes that the Taliban would respond in kind. But on Sunday, the Taliban announced their ceasefire had ended. The Taliban statement added that their ceasefire was for their fighters to celebrate the holiday peacefully and was not in response to the government's ceasefire announcement. We asked RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank what he makes of all the ceasefires.
Well, I think that the government of Afghanistan is trying to figure some way out of this stalemate. It has tried everything. It's tried every way of either fighting its way out or negotiating its way out. So now President Ghani is really just trying to figure out a different path.
There are critics who say that President Ghani's ceasefire actually shows the Taliban and allows them to flow more easily into cities and poses a concern for security forces.
Yes, and President Ghani is very well aware of this. This is a risky move. This is something that does definitely hold the potential for letting the Taliban infiltrate the cities and stay there. And perhaps launch a whole series of actions after that. Ashraf Ghani is very well aware of that. So his decision comes really as a bold move. We don't know whether it will succeed or fail.
Taliban has said the entire region should realize that there are no public or secret talks taking place with the Kabul regime.
Yes, well, that's been their consistent position, and it's probably accurate. We don't really have a way of knowing, but one of the things the Taliban is trying to do on the public relations side is to show that they have popular support in the cities. They have, before the ceasefire, said, we're going to come in and we're going to embrace our brethren. We're going to show that we really do represent the people. So one of the after effects of this will be for people to see in each of the cities they've gone in, have they been received well? Have the populace turned out to support them? Have the populace given them the cold shoulder? We don't really know this yet. And that's a big gamble for the government of Afghanistan, but also to some extent by the Taliban.
And on the question of any changes in U.S. policy regarding all of this since Mike Pompeo took over as Secretary of State, Dr. Blaint said it's simply too early to tell. He noted the last U.S. policy shift came in August of 2017. He says the biggest change is the addition of 5,000 extra U.S. troops, which he says is not a game changer. Jonah Blank is a senior political scientist with the think tank, the RAND Corporation. And as we've been reporting, President Trump is going ahead with a 25% tariff on $50 billion worth of Chinese technology imported into the U.S. China says they will retaliate. For a broader perspective, VOA Steve Miller asked Jacob Kierkegaard, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, if he sees these latest tariffs as a negotiating tactic.
I think you can look at it in two ways. On the one hand, you could say, well, they have announced they're going to do it, but they're not going to actually start collecting these tariffs until July 6th. So that gives you, if you like, a window of opportunity between this announcement and the actual economic effects coming into force to start a negotiating path. Now, at the same time, I think it's very clear that the administration, at any point in time when they had a choice to make in recent weeks and months on the issue of trade, they have chosen the most aggressive course of action. And I think, therefore, that the administration has taken this decision to have a new permanent or to in a permanent manner. They want to have a trade war with China.
It said that no one lives in a vacuum. We've seen these, as you say, the most aggressive stance taken by the Trump administration when it comes to tariffs and in terms of negotiating trade relations. What is going to be the impact on the global economy as we have more and more tariffs laid out by the United States?
Well, I mean, it's an unambiguous negative. The only question is how negative. And, you know, frankly, to date, I have, you know, when I look at the markets today, I'm a little surprised, actually, that they're not more, that there isn't much of a more negative sentiment. Because whereas we previously, in my opinion, you know, talked a lot about a potential trade war between China and the United States, I think we're now in one, and that does make a difference. And I think we're in one which isn't going to end anytime soon and will likely escalate.
But couldn't the markets just be saying, okay, we've seen both China and the United States say we're going to impose tariffs on one another, and then they have a quick round of talks, they back off, and everything goes back to normal?
No, I mean, that seems to be the bet. Now, I must say, at this point, I think that's a high-risk strategy, let me put it that way, because I think the Chinese are going to retaliate. I think we have the Trump administration previously talked about, you know, seeing that $50 billion and raising them another 50 and adding another $100 billion in retaliation to potential Chinese retaliation, and I think it may come to that, and then we will see how far that tit for tat goes. And I think if you add on top of this announcement by the administration of a National Security 232 investigation into the auto industry. You know, this is, it seems pretty clear to me that this is an administration that is going to push this trade war agenda with not just China, but frankly, with the rest of the world. I'm sort of fearful that we're in a bit of a complacency mode from markets, and then all of a sudden, the markets will wake up and they will have a moment of clarity, or perhaps an excessively negative reaction. This tends to be often how markets work.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he was speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. As Stephen Hawking was laid to rest the other day in London, the European Space Agency paid tribute in a special way. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda has a report.
The words of the legendary physicist Stephen Hawking are being used in a final tribute in a very fitting way, by being blasted into space with a message of peace. Friday was Hawking's memorial service at London's famous Westminster Abbey, his final resting place among the likes of Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin.
I have long wanted to go into space.
His voice, beamed the same day by the European Space Agency toward a black hole over 3,000 light years away.
There is unlimited potential for what the human mind can learn and develop.
Hawking's work on black holes was among his most influential, building on the ideas put forward by Albert Einstein and challenging many scientific assumptions about them. Music set with his voice is from the famed composer Vangelis, now going with Hawking to a place none of us have seen with the naked eye. And who knows, maybe someone or something we'll hear it before it gets there.
That is Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reporting. U.S. astronaut Peggy Whitson, who has spent more time in space than any other American, has finally decided to retire. During her career, Whitson logged 665 days in space over three separate missions. That's the equivalent of about 1 year and 10 months outside the Earth's atmosphere. President Trump honored her accomplishment in April of last year.
Dr. Whitson, I just, congratulations, amazing. What an amazing thing that you've done. Everybody here, I know your family, but everybody here is incredibly proud of the record you just broke. I hope that every young American watching today finds in your example a reason to love space and think about space, because many great things are going to come out, tremendous discoveries in medicine and so many other fields.
Whitson was the first woman to command the International Space Station. She did that twice and was the oldest woman ever to fly in space. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study led by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, found evidence that we humans are causing the world's mammals to become more nocturnal. Published in the journal Science, the new study is said to be the first to determine the effects humanity is having on the day-to-day activities of wildlife around the planet. To reach their findings, the researchers analyzed data on 62 species across six of the world's continents. The animal behavior data they studied was collected using a variety of methods, including direct observation and remote-controlled cameras. According to the paper's lead author, Caitlin Gaynor of Berkeley, animals throughout the world responded strongly to all types of human disturbance, even when people weren't posing a direct threat. She says this suggests that just our mere presence is enough to disrupt their natural behavioral patterns. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music. Whitney Houston was an American singer, actress, and producer. She was one of the best-selling musical artists of all time, with 200 million records sold worldwide. To me, and so I learned to depend on me. I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadows. If I fail, if I succeed, at least I live as I believe. No matter what they take from me, they can't take away my dignity. Houston released 7 studio albums and 2 soundtrack albums, all of which went either diamond, multi-platinum, platinum, or gold. It was her crossover appeal on the popular music charts that inspired and influenced several African-American women artists who followed in her footsteps. In 2009, Guinness World Records cited Whitney Houston as the most awarded female act of all time because of songs like I Want to Dance with Somebody. Houston made her screen acting debut in the film The Bodyguard in 1992. She performed the lead single from the film's original soundtrack, I Will Always Love You, which received the Grammy Award for Record of the Year and became the best-selling single by a woman in music history.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way, so I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way. And
February 2012, Whitney Houston was found dead in her hotel room in Beverly Hills, California. Her co-star in The Bodyguard, Kevin Costner, paid tribute to the pop icon at her funeral in her home state of New Jersey.
Whitney returns home today to the place where it all began. And I urge us all inside and outside across the nation and around the world to dry our tears, suspend our sorrow, and perhaps our anger, just long enough to remember the sweet miracle of Whitney.
Thank you. know, that might be one of the most covered songs of all time, but, you know, no one sings it like Whitney Houston. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Whitney Houston.
Life treats you kind, and I hope you have all you dreamed of, and I wish you joy and happiness, but above all this, I wish you
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For nearly a decade now, Boko Haram has used violence in an effort to force its twisted ideology on the people of northeast Nigeria and has also launched vicious attacks in Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. At least 20,000 civilians have been killed in the conflict, and hundreds of thousands more across the Lake Chad Basin are suffering extreme hardship as a result of this violence. Indeed, Boko Haram and its offshoot, ISIS West Africa, has contributed to a major humanitarian crisis in the region. Some 2.5 million people have been displaced, and nearly 11 million people across the region need assistance to survive. The Lake Chad Basin humanitarian emergency is among the most severe in the world. People affected by the ongoing conflict are facing hunger in northeast Nigeria, including over 1 million in hard-to-reach areas due to Boko Haram's presence. According to the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, at least 1 in 5 households in Nigeria's Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states may not be able to feed themselves without aid or may often go hungry through this coming September. Elsewhere, a significant number of people in Cameroon's far north region, Chad's Lac region, and Niger's Diffa region may also find it difficult to obtain enough food through September. On June 7th, U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria Stuart Symington announced nearly $112 million in additional humanitarian assistance to those needing help in the Lake Chad Basin, including nearly $102 million for people in Nigeria. The funds will provide life-saving aid to hundreds of thousands of people, including emergency food, nutrition treatment, shelter, health care, safe drinking water, services for survivors of sexual violence, and support to children separated from their families. The United States is the largest donor for the humanitarian response in the Lake Chad region. Since October 2016, the United States has provided nearly $761 million in humanitarian aid to the region. The United States remains committed to helping the people affected by the terrorist group Boko Haram and its offshoot, ISIS West Africa. A comprehensive political and security solution is ultimately the only way to bring peace to the region and end the suffering of the people there. The United States calls on the global community to follow our example and donate generously to address the basic life-saving needs of the displaced and the communities that host them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.